Welcome to episode 20 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. Before we get started, we are proud to announce that All of Your Business podcast has received a 2020 X-Ray Podcast Award presented by X-Ray FM. X-Ray FM, purpose-driven media at 91.1 FM and 107.1 FM, and find them online at xray.fm. On this episode, we're talking to Shiny Flannery from Scrapberry Farm. And now, executive producer and host, Michael Jonas.
Thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure.
So the first thing I wanted to ask you was, how did you get your name or nickname Shiny?
It's like a personal call to action. You know, my mom named me Allie Nay, which is a mouthful, and came with this like first day of school dread every year. Like, what are the ways they will mangle this name now? And in the eighth grade, I was sort of fluttering, and they're getting through, you know, like Davis, Edwards. I'm like, oh, it's coming. And so I just said, it's Allie. It's Allie. And then I went home and I told my mom, like, I went to school today and told them my name was Allie. And she said, oh, man, that was actually my only reservation when I named you Allie Nay. I thought someone might call her Allie, and that's such a dreadful little name. And then I persisted under that name for a really long time, and that's the name I used for my professional life as an educator. And along the way, I had a major partner breakup happen. And I was trying to remember, you know, like when you break up with someone, you're trying to remember, who were you before?
Yeah.
And I remember I said to myself, like, oh, man, I used to shine. Like, that you know, I had become so just, like, dragged down through the end of a partnership. I was like, what would it take to, like, get back there? To feel like I shine. And I was like, it takes getting up every day and deciding, like, today I fucking shine.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, like, I just started using that name in, like, queer community and other community spaces. And I had been, this was a really long time ago, so I had been in grad school and had sort of joked around about, like, being this shiny librarian, because I went to grad school in a paradigm change in library studies. Yeah. So being, like, a nerdy techie kid was just starting to happen in libraries. And so people were like, wow, she's so shiny. Like, how does she know these things, you know? But, yeah, mostly it was just, like, this personal call to action. Like, how do I want to be in the world? Like, I want to be the kind of person where when people regurgitate that, like, hi, how are you question, that I'm like, I'm freaking awesome. How are you?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and that's, like, a choice. It's a million tiny choices every day. So that's how that came in.
And it's just, it's cool. It's just stuck.
It's just stuck. Yeah. And now, you know, that's, if you went up to somebody in farm and market land and were like, oh, well, I interviewed Allie recently. They'd be like, I don't know who, you know, my folks are a little like, we don't know what your name is, but okay. We're excited.
Yeah. The old expression is, as long as you don't call me late to dinner, you can call me whatever you want.
There's some of that, you know, but then I think the trade-off, right, is when you have a complex name that's perceived as ethnic, white people already do everything they can to call you something else.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
So now there's just sort of like, it's just the one. It's like Cher or Madonna. Nobody asked them, you know? They're just like, oh, here we go. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of weird, but it's my thing.
So, you know, you mentioned your parents and naming and things like that. Tell me a little bit about that, about, you know, your childhood, what your family was like.
Yeah. I grew up in Oakland. And when I tell people about where I come from and how I grew up, I feel like you always have to add on, like, I grew up in Oakland that was ravaged by a government-funded crack epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what people see when they go to Oakland now, and it's like, oh, what a lovely, like, multicultural city. That's not my Oakland. That's not where I grew up, you know? And I grew up still a very privileged kid in so far as these things go. You know, and there are lots of kinds of privilege, and I like to try to name them as I go along. And I wouldn't say that we had a ton of money, but we also weren't struggling, like, every kid I went to school with, their family was struggling. And, you know, my mom was a white lady. And she passed away quite a while ago now. And my dad, my stepdad, is like a 6'8" taciturn black man.
6'8", wow.
Yeah. And so, consequently, I grew up thinking that short people were shady. Because I just grew up around tall people. And I was like, that's how the good ones come. Whoa, short people. But yeah, I grew up in Oakland in the 80s. And never, like, if you had asked then, like, hey, this kid, like, is this kid going to grow up to be a farmer one day? People would be like, no, no. Like, nobody, no little black kids who grow up in Oakland think they're going to grow up to be a farmer one day. That's, like, so far out of the realm. And all the same, I had this urge, because I think all kids want to grow something, right? Mm-hmm. And so I had this urge to grow carrots and sunflowers. Those were the things I wanted to make go. And so I was privileged that I had a place called Backyard. And most of Backyard was like broken cement, but it was still mine, you know, and I got to go have adventures there. And so everywhere I could find like a patch of dirt to try to stick a carrot seed or a sunflower seed in, I would. And occasionally you'd get very like leggy, scraggly little plants, but really nothing much to show for it. And so what I kind of concluded from that was like, oh, right, this thing called green thumb is real. And some people can grow plants and some people cannot grow plants. And I must be a not grow plants because my concrete, you know, cracks aren't growing any sunflowers for me. Not was really it, understanding
was
how
there
that works.
Someone who taught you about gardening or someone you saw, like maybe in your neighborhood that did that? Or was it just your own curiosity? You're like, one day, you know,
nope.
Why not do this?
The street I grew up on in Oakland is a street that has pretty much one residential house on it. And that's the house I grew up in. And everything else is like converted to an apartment building. So nobody gardens anything in, you know, 1984, like tiny, shiny Oakland. I don't know where I really got that idea. Maybe we did a class project with, you know, plastic cups and seeds. But no, I didn't grow up watching people garden in that way. I think the apartment complex across the street from my house maybe had a landscaper, which might have been the closest to anything I would have seen that looked like gardening. So it really was not a part of my worldview growing up. And is such a fluke that I'm here doing that now, you know? But I was a really nerdy kid. I was a really nerdy kid who didn't have any friends. And I talked all the time, like all the time. That hasn't changed. I'm still a nerdy kid. I have some friends now. I've learned how to chill out a little bit, which helps with the friends. But I was like super intense and nerdy as a child. And that kid who like walks down the sidewalk on busy streets reading books, like I'm that kid. Because in Oakland, there are no school buses. So you either take the public bus or you walk. And so when the weather was crummy, you took the public bus and you hoped that like people behaved and like weird handsy old guys didn't like interact with you and have all these things going on. Otherwise, you walked. And so how I made that walk every day was with a book. And how I got through anything that looked like outside time during school was with a book. And I really just tried to keep my head down. Because Oakland in the 80s is a hard place to be a mixed black kid. You know, like poverty shapes people's lives in really hard ways that make differences seem so stark. And so even though I had, in a lot of ways, the same life as the kids I went to school with, there was this obvious difference, right? Like, I had a white parent who dropped me off for things. Mm. And that created so much resentment, you know, which is just internalized systematic crap. But, yeah, it just created such a weird structure. So I didn't learn how to make friends until I was, like, 12 and we moved away from Oakland. Like, that's when I learned how to make friends, but in a really inauthentic way. Like, yeah. I moved somewhere else, and I was like, they don't know I'm a nerd! Like, just don't let on.
And did you move here to Portland, or where did
no,
you move?
No, I moved to Southern California for a couple years as a kid. So, yeah, 8th and 9th grade I did in Southern California, and I was, like, a renegade who never went to class and, like, drank all day at school and yelled at teachers. and spent most of my time in school suspension. And then I moved out of my mom's house when I was 15. And I sent myself to boarding school, which is like a very weird path, right? Like that's not a super common thing. But my mom wasn't doing super well. So by this point we're on our own. And we'd spent most of my childhood on our own. And my mom had a lot of kind of rampant and unchecked mental illness. And so there just came a point when her friend called me and she said, "You got to get out of that house. And I don't care how you do it, but go somewhere because your mom is going to live up your whole life for you. And there's not going to be much left for you." And then she said, "If you ever tell your mom I said that, like, I will tell her what a lying kid you are." And so I went to the public library and got a directory of boarding schools and just started paging through it, looking at lists of schools. And I told my mom, basically, like, "You're going to co-sign a loan or I'm going to call, like, CPS on you."
That's what I was going to ask you, is it's got to be expensive. I mean, boarding, it's so expensive. When you think about boarding school, it's
elite. Like, it's privileged elite. Like, that is the upper echelon of teenage privilege elite right there. Absolutely. We got a loan for part of it, and I got some financial aid, like some grants from the school. And in exchange, I worked in the front office after school answering phones for like rich parents who couldn't find their kids.
And where was this?
This was in, so I went back to the Bay Area. So this is in a place called Danville, California, which is like where most of your Bay Area football players, pro basketball players, like they all live up there. Gated communities, like very, very fancy. And like a handful of kids of color who bus and take a train in from wherever they live. And then some boarding school students who live on campus. And it's a really tiny college prep school. And you call the teachers by their first name. And they have a lot of like very sort of nature influenced programming. So you have to do a backpacking trip to graduate. And the school was the model that eventually became Outward Bound.
Okay.
And so also things I never would have seen happening in my life, you know, from kid who grows up in Oakland talking to like snails on the front porch because she doesn't have friends, to like boarding school and backpacking trips and a trip to like Broadway to see musicals. And we came to Ashland to do Shakespeare and do all of these things. And in exchange, I worked in the office, and then eventually I worked in the library for nights when I lived at school. And what that gave me was such incredible privilege, because what I got from that was feeling easy at being like close to whiteness. Like I spent all of this time with really privileged kids who came from super rich families, and I would get invited to those places to stay for holidays and things like that. And I just got very comfortable being around powerful whiteness. And also learning how to mold myself in a way that was really palatable to whiteness. And I think that's like, you know, the privilege that I always feel I should name the most is
tell me more about that.
Yeah. Right. Like I code switch really, really well, you know, so I can move in community space and talk with my folks and, you know, then move into a boardroom, move into a conference room, move into public speaking, and present things in a way that is just comically edgy instead of unnervingly black. And what I've learned is that that gets you a lot of places and will open a lot of doors, and it also costs you a lot personally. Like, what will make a person stop shining is like catering to whiteness all the time. So it's a double-edged sword, you know?
Do you think that that's, I mean, I hope it's changing some of, there are people who would rather have you for you than, you know, you code switching, so that, I guess it depends on the forum and
yeah. You know. I mean, I would say it's a yes and. Yes, I do think it's changing some, in part because I've been changing. So in the last couple of years of my career as a librarian in higher ed, which was a pretty good career, I was on a national speaking circuit, like I was doing things, I stopped code switching. I just went to PCC and was black as hell every day. And it was really entertaining to watch people have this reaction. And like, if you're gonna try that out in a kind of edgy community college with a pretty liberal mission, is not a bad place to check it out, you know. But for a couple years there, I just quit code switching and watched how people reacted to that. And then when I left that environment, kind of like when I left the seventh grade and decided people didn't need to know I had been a certain way before, I emerged into doing farm and market and food systems work that I do now as a person who had just always never code switched, and as a person who was always unapologetically Black and unapologetically queer. And so I find that a lot of people do receive that in the spirit it's intended, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people are just like, oh, okay, this is how you are now. And, you know, I swear a lot, but maybe not in all of the meetings. and I try to keep a little bit of balance, but I'm also very clear with people that, like, I don't exist to make anything comfortable for them.
Sure.
And I think that that gets... Well, maybe not easier for people, but that is more apparent to people as a thing they should not argue with the more we see the fight for Black lives play out, you know, on the national media. Yeah.
Well, and that's a big part of why I think some of this continues. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but I think Black people spend so much time doing what you're saying, code switching, teaching white people who should be able to teach themselves, constantly asking, how did I do? How does that appear? Mm-hmm. When you should just be able to be. You should just be able to be who you are in that moment.
Yeah.
So it's got to be exhausting for you to have done that for so long, and then for anybody to do it for that long or to continue to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're sacrificing who you are yourself for whatever organization you're a part of. And I guess the worry would be, and you can tell me, if you act like yourself in some of those circumstances, you may not get the job, or you may not get a raise, or right. You may not, you know, whatever it may be, a long list.
Yeah. No, all of that is incredibly true. It's exhausting, and it shaves away parts of you, you know, and the longer you do it, the less of you there is. And the other thing that happens is, I think the more time you spend moving through the world inauthentically, you know, not just really being yourself and true to yourself and your vision and values, then the more people can just perceive you're kind of off, right? So on the one hand, you're playing games to get the thing, you know, the job, the chance, the hookup, the mentor, the whatever. But then also once you get there, right, like people know when you're fake. It's just, you know when people are faking it. Whether they're faking it to making it kind of doesn't matter sometimes, right? Like, you know that they're fake. And so I know when I move through the world, you know, because it'll still happen. It happens to everybody. It's a part of kind of the fight or flight response, is sometimes you freeze, sometimes you fawn, and sometimes you just feign whiteness. And you have to do that to survive sometimes, but it's all a balancing act, right? So I'm trying not to live in a world where I consent to being part of a large machine that just sort of grinds away at me anymore. And I also don't consent to move through the world in a way that is stripping me of my authenticity. And if people aren't into that, well, cool, fuck them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think what's interesting about you too is, you know, there's a lot of intersectionality of race and being queer and figuring out how all those things work together. And everyone thinks that they have the answer, or they know the answer, or they tell you who you should be or what you should be. So I would imagine in the intersectionality of all that, you just have to be like, this is who I am. I can't change myself for every single person. I can't, you know, be this for you or that for you. So do you think there's a time in your life where you realize that you felt like, this is me and that's it, you know, I'm gonna be who I am? Was that something that happened early on for you, or is that something that happened recently?
You know, I think it has happened gradually in sort of waves. You know, I want to say, like, yeah, I was always this kind of kid who was, you know, but no, because I think the other part of the narrative is that I live with a tremendous amount of anxiety. I think that, like, all Black people live with a tremendous amount of anxiety. But, like, I get to have the fun, super ramped up clinical kind. So I spend a lot of time thinking about how I'm being perceived and what's coming across. And so it's, yeah, it's this duality of being very worried about everything all the time, including how you are perceived and how you come across and how you are showing yourself. And is it in the best light? And also, right, like, I'm a cynical Gen X punk rock kid from Oakland, and that is always going to shape a core piece of my identity. And so I think the more that I'm able to sort of wash away those layers I built up working in the machine of higher ed and working alongside whiteness all the time, like, the more I'm washing away those layers, I am finding this steely core that is very Oakland. And what a lot of my Portland friends will say, because I've been here for 17 years now, is they're like, you just have a face and it says, bitch, I'm from Oakland.
Yeah.
And that's my answer for a lot of things where people are like, well, why are you, why would you do? And sometimes I really will just say, I don't know, I'm from Oakland.
Yeah.
As though that just sort of explicates all of it. Like,
well, and it sounds like that may mean or translate into, I just don't have time to be something else.
Yeah.
This is, you know, you take it or leave it. Let's move forward with what we have to do.
Increasingly now, I don't have time, right? Like, I am wearing so many hats. I don't have time to be something else. And I think, I didn't get that until you said it, but, like, that's kind of a gift. Like, people ask me all the time, like, how do you stay so busy? Why do you stay so busy? And some of that's the anxiety. Like, if everything stopped moving, I'm not sure what would be left except me and my stressed out thoughts. But part of all of that also is, like, I don't have time to manufacture anything for anyone,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's a gift, really. Like, that's a gift. And sometimes that's a gift that costs you things, right? You're not always going to get the contract when you just tell the person, like, I don't want to sell you my herbal products because I think you're appropriative.
Mm-hmm.
Like, cool. Well, I did not get that wholesale contract, but I also didn't have time to manufacture whatever it was going to take to get that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Let's talk about that for a minute about, and after that, you know, I want to get into all your ventures.
Yeah,
there's
for
so many
sure.
things, but, you know, there is this sort of push for, BIPOC support, and some of it is good and some of it is genuine and some of it is corporate and is marketing mm-hmm. and is appropriating and is sort of taking advantage. So how do you know when someone is being genuine? I mean, do you ask questions? Is it you kind of get a feel for that based on the relationship?
I do. I ask questions of, you know, the person or the company and of community. Like, hey, what do you know about this? You know, we absolutely believe in my communities that chisme, gossip of a sort, like productive gossip, is really vital and it's what keeps communities safe. So, hey fam, what do you know about this store or this guy or this Etsy shop or whatever it is, you know, like, what do you know about this? What have you heard? What has anyone experienced? And then you kind of sift through there. But then I also ask the person or the company, you know, I'll say, hey, like, I've got some really hard questions for you. What are you doing about racial equity?
Mm-hmm.
Like, actively, I don't want to know your thoughts about it. Like, I want to know your actions. What are you doing? What are the verbs? I will ask them, what will it be like for you and how will you take action when you, not if you, but when you screw up?
Mm.
When you screw something up in terms of culture and ethics, how are you going to react to being called in for that? And I try to make it clear, right? Like, my first go-to is not calling out. It's not taking to social media to trash your company.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming to you and saying, hey, there was a huge miss. Here's where it happened. We need to sit down and talk about it. And what are your next steps going to be? And I really judge a lot based on if people even have an answer to that. So few people will take a crack at it.
Sure.
Just sort of go, whoo, shiny. That's a lot. And I'm like, yeah. And what do you got for me? And very few people will take even a crack at it. And I think it's important, right? Like, nobody's perfect. And I don't expect perfection from people. I expect learning and sort of like growth reflective behavior, you know? So if you screwed it up and you were doing, I don't know, appropriative shenanigans with white sage in your store, and I came in and said, hey, I'm representing BIPOC community. and BIPOC farmers and herbal medicine makers, and this thing is going on, I want to hear a response that isn't just like, oh man, I'm so sorry, I'll change everything right away, because I don't think that's real for a business.
Sure.
You know, and I also don't want to be blown off. I don't want to get that like, oh, that's a lot, you know, so.
Well, it's almost like they have to understand what they're doing, why it is offensive, mm-hmm. because how would they ever in the future move forward? I've also seen people, you know, we have some clients who have done this, which we've had conversations where they don't like the comments, and so they just delete them all.
Right.
And I'm like, that's not what we're doing. Like, that's yeah. not. So it is a fine balance. And I like what you said about growth, that and this goes for everything. You know, there are people who are clearly hateful who will never be in a mode of improving, growing, and reflective. Mm-hmm. Then there are people who really do care. They're just not there, right?
Yeah.
So they don't, you know, they believe in trans rights, but they don't get the pronouns right all the time.
Totally.
They really do care about Black people, but they've done all sorts of, like, microaggressions and maybe, you know, and they'll stop and they'll listen and they'll mm-hmm. actually learn. So I think what I'm kind of wondering for you, and it's kind of the question, is how do we figure out who is the person who is like, or the company who is, okay, we'll grow, and versus the, like, what you're saying, this is not cool and you didn't make any change.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the answer is you just have to wait and see sometimes, which is a hard answer.
You do. I mean, there is a lot of wait and see. I think there's a couple places that there are some litmus tests or some check-ins. So I like to talk a lot about white supremacy culture as opposed to white supremacy. And white supremacy culture is a term coined by a scholar named Tama Okun. And if you just do a web search for white supremacy culture, you'll find all this person's writing about it. But white supremacy culture has these really particular symptoms. And so very often those symptoms show up when you try to call somebody in about something they're doing that's problematic. And so those symptoms are things like perfectionism, like a sense of urgency. And so if I were like an over-reliance on words, I think is also a big part of like white supremacy culture. And so if I were to interact with someone or their company about something that happened, if the things they start saying are like, well, we'll get on that immediately, you know, because that doesn't allow time for reflection and growth and probably some reading and searching and like, what is this lady even telling me I did?
One of the biggest ones, you know, is I'm not racist.
Yeah. Right. So that's just, let me throw some words at the thing. If I just put some words on it, that'll solve the thing. Right. So that's kind of like an obvious red flag that like, man, this is not getting in, you know, or if they're just. Also, they can't take action on something because they can't find the perfect response. Then that's a real strong indicator, which is a thing I've gotten back from people all the time, right? So they want to pull together a review team and an advisory board. It's almost the opposite of the like rush to solve the thing,
mm-hmm.
Is you can just bog it down in looking for the most perfect solution. When I feel like people are really getting it, and we've had a lot of opportunities this year to see companies screwing stuff up and trying to make it right in some way. You know, everybody doing a rebrand, changing their product names, all kinds of things going on. The ones who just kind of come out and say, whoa, we screwed up. We're not exactly sure in detail how and why, but we hear you that we messed it up. And we're going to go back to the drawing board and we're going to invite you to the drawing board with us, not to solve it for us, but to help us hear and see. Those are the indications to me that something is growth oriented,
mm-hmm.
right? Like it acknowledges that this entity that probably is representing space somewhere in the, you know, dominant power narrative, is able to just slow down, acknowledge that they messed something up, and take the time to figure that out. I think that's huge.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I see is, you know, and I present as a cis white male, and you know, I have a boyfriend, I come from a Jewish family, but mm-hmm. I feel privileged in that way. I am maybe a little bit more aware of things than most, but it's the same thing. And I often see other people who present as white with this sort of white savior complex.
Yeah.
Of this is not an opportunity necessarily to help BIPOC communities, but it's more so and more importantly an opportunity for me to make money off of this. Right. And then I feel good from that making money and helping people. So people who really do want to help people genuinely, I get.
Mm-hmm.
When I see that sort of thing, I sort of go, I sort of, you know, roll my eyes and I'm like, come on.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
And I think one of the ways or one of the differences is if you're white, you may not have the ability to, or you shouldn't, diagnose, you know, what Black people need.
Yeah.
Instead, you should invite them in mm-hmm. to speak and give them representation.
Yeah.
And so I think that's also what I see a lot that makes me kind of want to bang my head against the wall is, why don't you ask the Black community yeah. what they may need instead of being like, this is what you need.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what's your thought on that? Like, sort of the white world prescribing to Black people what they need, and then they from that feel like I'm heroically saving you, mm-hmm. which kind of just repeats this really shitty cycle.
Right. It was like super messianic. Yeah, I mean, it like so many things I'm gonna say today, right? It's just about finding some balance, because we also don't want to tip over into a place where we're saying do all of the unpaid labor for us, right? So yes, we want to invite people into spaces, because I'm hammered with like white prescriptions all day long for what Black and brown farmers need. Well, what you need is this, and oh look, I went out without asking you and got you some of this. I'm like, I didn't need any of that, but okay, thank you. And at the same time, we want people to take action and to take initiative. And I think there are places where it's really easy that I can say, hey, white folks, if you feel moved to give Black and Indigenous people some money, do it. There's not a wrong way. Mm-hmm. Just give them some. Oh, do you want to give some land to Indigenous nations? Great. Just do it. There's really not a wrong way, other than some crap you know about the law and contracts and how that should all play out, you know. But like, there are easy places to say, yeah, you could make a huge impact there, without having to undertake a lot of dialogue about the right way to do a thing. And that's about giving over resources without mm-hmm. strings attached. But outside of that, yeah, like you have to design a process that's really inclusive. And I think that's the thing that gets lost a lot, right? It is design, it's work, it's intentional work at building a process. And a process is a product. Right? Like, it's not just this ethereal thing. Like, a process can be documented and looked at. We can touch and understand a process in a certain way. And so designing inclusive processes has to be more than just a buzzword, right? And inclusion and equity are so buzzy right now.
Mm-hmm.
But often in a way that doesn't mean a lot. Like, we just keep saying these things. That's that, like, white supremacy culture throwing words at it again.
Yeah.
So
the thing that you're mentioning, I think, is, like, that superficial level of, you know, we can tell everybody that we have a DEI policy mm-hmm. and we can put out this statement, but really, like, does it dig deep? Did we actually talk about the real issue?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I worry about as a society right now with any, I mean, I worry about a lot, but, you know, I'm worried about the normalization of hate. I'm worried about people making up their own facts or truths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then the thing that really worries me is these are wounds that go deep. I mean, 400 years of racial oppression
mm-hmm.
and systematic racism, and, you know, the list goes on. Land ownership, home ownership, jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean,
all of it.
Hunger, yep. which we're going to talk about. So, one, I think Black people are really patient to come up, like, to keep trying to keep on going, like they could just be like, fuck it, I'm done,
right?
We keep doing this. Police brutality, I didn't even mention.
Yeah,
a big one. So yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say is, how do we have these deep conversations? Because it seems like people either avoid them, or the moment that they happen, people get offended and they run away. And I sort of feel like nobody heals unless they actually dig deep and actually take the time. And it mm-hmm. could be painful, it could lead to, you know, name calling or asking someone like, who has held deep fear, like, why does that fear exist?
Yeah.
So I guess the question is, how do ordinary people do this work and move forward when we're in a time where everybody wants to just remain cute and shallow, mm-hmm. and, you know,
hashtag
put out
good vibes only.
Yeah, put out a cute little policy and be like, we're good.
Yeah.
Like, what's your opinion on that? Like, how do we dig deeper?
Well, so first, I want to say that I don't know if it's that Black people are that patient, right? I think what can look like patience is a combination of patience for some generations, inertia for others, and just, like, outright, like, traumatic paralysis. And all of those can look sort of like, wow, these Black people are just biding their time so nicely, so patiently. But for some of it, it's like, wow, you know, these Black people have been waiting for us to get our shit together for so long that I'm not sure if they're treading water or drowning right now.
Sure.
Right?
So some of it is numbness.
Yeah. There's, you know, there's a lot of that going on. And then I think, you know, I'll get to, like, what can everyday individual folks do in a second. But the one thing I want to say about, like, organizations that I'm seeing happen is, so, right, everybody wants the equity and the inclusion. What I'm starting to see some groups get right is recognizing that you may have to pay for BIPOC representation in a way that you might. So, like, let's say you're putting together an advisory group, right? And you want to have Black and Indigenous and immigrant representation on it. Well, those folks move through the economy differently, and they need different stabilization to be able to show up and participate in that endeavor. And especially if you want them to come in and sort of ground truth or road test your new policy and practices, then you especially have to be paying them. So I have gotten a couple of invitations to do paid advisory council work now. And I think that's really important. And so seeing more of that happen, I think is good. Now that's not, you know, it's not about individuals, but what do everyday people do? I farm on Wapato Island, so I'll tell you a story because that's how I know how to talk. So I farm on Wapato Island, which white people call Savi, and that's a whole other story. Out there on the island is a cattle farmer named Christine, and Christine's amazing, and I met her at a farmer's market, and she wrote me a message on Instagram once, and she said, "Shiny, I just had this thought while I was out running this morning, and now I can't stop having it." And she was really great. She said, "Do you have time and space to hear my thought?" I was like, "Yeah, totally." And she said, "I was out running, like I go running all the time. And I run through other people's farms and fields and whatever, and I've never thought about it." And she's like, "Shiny, a man was running, minding his own business, and got, like, assaulted and killed, you know, in this country." And somehow it, like, clicked for her while she was out there.
She's talking about Ahmad.
Yeah, she's talking about Ahmad. And she says, you know, like, it just clicked while I was running, like, in my whole body jolted, and I realized that, like, oh, Black people can't just go running past their neighbors' properties, you know, in rural America, like it's nothing, or even in urban or suburban America. She's like, you all can't go running anywhere you want to. And it was this simple thing, and I love Christine for having had a reflection about something really simple that was within her grasp, right? Like, she didn't have to get a book. She wasn't sitting around doing, like, me and white supremacy workbooks and all of those kinds of things. There's no Ta-Nehisi Coates on her, you know, bookshelf, I don't think. But she had this really profound thought about a really simple thing, and then she reached out and asked consent to share that thought and to check in about how that was for me. And she was really gracious, because I was like, I don't have time to think about this with you now that I know what it is, you know, I'll get back to you one day. And she was like, yeah, absolutely. And it took like a year, you know, almost to have that talk with her again. Like, it took a really long time to get back to that. I think, well, a year. Time is wibbly wobbly in a pandemic. Yeah, however long it's been, you know. Yeah, and I think it's that, right? It's having that reflection about everyday things, recognizing that, like, racism and white supremacy play out in the things that you move through the world doing casually all the time. And then checking in with someone about the reactions that you're having. And it's really different, right? Like, she didn't ask me to hold her feelings. She didn't ask me to process her feelings. And she told me, like, I've talked to a bunch of people, white people already, about my feelings. But I just wanted to ask you about some of my conclusions, you know? And I thought that was beautiful. And then to have the grace to understand when I was like, nope, I don't have that energy right now. Like, there's LRADs going off in my neighborhood all the time. I can't think about your experiences with understanding this. But I think that that's a powerful model, like examining your life and the way that you move through everyday things. So when you go in a grocery store wearing a mask, does anyone follow you around? You know, like these little things. And if you notice that they do or they don't, or they do or do not do that to someone else, like, how can you talk to some other people about what you experienced and what you saw? And then how can you ask a Black person or any person of color, you know, for some perspective on that? And if you realize you don't know any Black people or any people of color who would actually have that dialogue with you, that actually gives you an action point, you know? And I don't think that means you go out and start accosting brown people like, hey, will you be my friend? Right. But then you start interrogating your life and your social circles and your community and wondering how it is you move through a world in Portland. And it's not that hard to move through Portland never actually knowing any Black people. Right. But I think you start to open up and ask yourself, where are the places that I can make more connections? Because I think we have to, and it's a little Pollyanna, but, you know, we have to see each other as people, like whole ass people with complex lives and experiences, before we can really start to unpack
all of
these complex systems.
That's why I appreciate that story. And that's a really interesting thing. I mean, the easiest, simplest theory, the contact theory, you know, for psychology or sociology is just when you meet someone you don't know, the walls come down. Mm-hmm. When you actually hear their story, you realize they're human. You know, you realize the implicit bias that you held for them may not be true. But then there are people who they don't want to be in that. They continuously, you know, I have to live in a white community. I have to live in a white town. Like, they sort of create a bubble for themselves and they continue in that bubble.
Let them.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that I think that I've had to learn is, you know, I like in it, I tell my boyfriend some of the people are like zombies, like they've been taken, you know, like they're not in a category of wanting to grow or wanting to reflect.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only so much that you or I or anybody can do to get to someone who doesn't want to make these changes, or doesn't want to look inside their heart and ask, you know, could I do this differently? Could I be different?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I struggle with. That's incredibly sad to me that there are people that are like that, that we just can't move, you know, through all that's gone on with history. You know, we had a Black president, you know, I'm sure that there are African-American people in their community, teachers, doctors, and still, these still are in this sort of, I don't know, Twilight Zone, colonial, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And so it's shocking to me, you know, like the 70 million people, for example, who are complicit with this behavior.
Right.
How do you just decide, as someone who works in this field, the person who I'm trying to help has to make the decision to actively want to change, you know, and if there's someone who doesn't, then I can't really help that other person right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think about it like ant movement, right? And I think that, right, in our casual armchair science kind of way, we like to think about ants as these, like, amazing collectivists. Like, look at them move. And what I learned about ants one day from a quirky bug guy was that they actually don't enact this tremendous, like, collective movement. What they're very good at is dragging. So when the, you know, the ant platoon is marching along and decides to, like, everybody go left because that's where the peanut butter is, there are lots and lots of ants that don't actually get the message or do not go along. Like, they want to do their own shit. And what other ants do is just drag them until their bodies rip apart. and what I'm not trying to do, right? So, like, what I'm not trying to do and call anti-racism is drag white people along until they fall apart. Sure. They are no longer people, right? Like, I'm trying to meet white people and be like, hey, I see your humanity and you as a person, and I want you to see that in me. And if all we're doing collectively is dragging these people who are not ready along, all we're doing is ripping them apart. They do not actually arrive at the destination a whole person. Just like those ants, like 30% of the ants don't arrive at the peanut butter a whole ant. They've been ripped apart in some way. And some of them are down a couple, you know, limbs and they're doing okay. And some of them are just dead. And so in the same way, like, I want to get to wherever it is we're trying to get to with whole people who are also seeing me as a whole person. Sure. And I can't do that if I'm just, like, denigrating people, saying that, like, right, like, you're actually just a terrible human. You don't get to be a human in the way that you are. I can say you don't get to do that here, right? And so I don't keep those people in my space.
Sure, and you've probably seen, you know, those black people that go to, like, a KKK rally and try to hug people. And
that's dangerous and foolish. I don't know what that is. Stop that.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so that's the thing is, you know, those people who act like that are not on a pathway to change. And so do you still give them the message? You just don't work on them? And then they may come around, or do you just, you know, why bother?
I don't. And I'll tell you why. I went to a workshop, I don't know, a year or two ago, for faculty and staff of color who've experienced racial oppression. So all the faculty and staff of color. And the facilitator, a woman named Danette Gillespie Otto here in Portland, asked this question at the end. And this is the question that changes my whole life. This is the question for how Shiny leaves higher ed. She said at the end of it, so listen, if you just accepted that white supremacy would never end in your lifetime, it will not happen as a part of your lived experience, what would you do with your precious life force? And I was like, oh shit. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I still wake up and think that question every day. And so to that end, I've stopped trying to make that connection. You know, like, hey, I've got some info about how you could be less crappy. Would you like it? No, okay, bye.
Mm-hmm.
Because it isn't doing anything to keep me alive and whole and shining. It is just, you know, dragging me down along with it, going the other direction. So if people reach out to me and say, hey, I want to have this dialogue, open my thoughts, do some more stuff, we'll try to find a way that we can do that and not wear each other down. But if they're not into it or they're not ready for it, that's just like throwing my life force away. And I'm pretty sure that that's the opposite of what I should be doing at any given time. So I am moving in the direction every day of doing more things with my life force that are good for me. And not doing things that are good for other people if they're not ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. And that's a good question that lady had for
you. Yeah. Go
so let's get to all your many ventures.
Yeah, let's do it.
You know, you do farming, you do market stuff, mm-hmm. you do food related. I mean, how do you tell people, like, if I say, you know, this is Shiny, this is what she does, mm-hmm. or you say, hey, I'm Shiny, this is what I do, like, how would you describe for people what you do?
I mean, I say in a nutshell that I'm a farmer and a farmer's market manager, and that is a very slender description for all the things that I do. What that really means is that I farm under my business name, Scrapberry Farm, out on Wapato Island. And I take the things that I grow and I make them into herbal wellness products. And I sell those to people at markets that I sign up to go sell things at. And then I also run a BIPOC farmers market called Come Through Market. And really, there's a lot packed into that market because it's an incubator market. So I'm supporting up and coming entrepreneurs in Portland who are either farmers or food makers or other makers of some kind. And so there's a whole lot ensconced in that. But most people aren't really that invested in knowing about all of the things that go into supporting Black and Indigenous entrepreneurs. So it's really, you know, I farm. And I think the really, like, the short version is, like, I grow stuff, I make stuff, I help other people grow stuff and make stuff.
How do those things come about? Like, how do you don't just say, or maybe you do one day, I'm going to become a farmer.
Yeah. It was a path, and it's actually been a very condensed journey. And because I am really bad at time, I was laughing earlier today getting ready for this and thinking, I've probably told this story in a number of interviews and given a different timeline for all of them. So I made myself write it down. I was like, okay, squirrely brain, like, time is one of my least, time and money, like, these human made constructs, time, money, and gender, like, so useless. And yet they constrain our lives in so many ways. So in the spring of 2018, really on kind of a fluke, I took an herbal medicine making class in the back of a little bookstore in Selwood, like, had a tiny kitchen back there. And I took these classes with a woman named Jenny, and I just really liked the way that she talked about plants. So I went off to, like, a very shitty white witchcraft conference in Portland. Like, whoa, Portland witches and herb people are so just mired in all of the appropriation and racism. So I went off to this little magic conference because there's a lot of crossover between plant people and magic people. Also in the spring of 2018. And while I was there, I met a person that I now farm with, an indigenous Mexican farmer, and started talking to them about, like, wow, this conference is really uncomfortable. Is this uncomfortable for you? And they were like, yeah, I'm part of this organization called Sacred Lattice, which is, like, for BIPOC folks trying to, like, reclaim these ancestral ways of knowing. You should come hang out with us. And I was like, great, that sounds awesome. That sounds a lot less terrible than this. Let's do that. And so I started hanging out with the Sacred Lattice Collective and learning a little bit about plant medicine and talking to plants with them. Went off to another crappy, racist, white, like, plant medicine gathering this time in November of 2018. Ran into some of those same people and was like, oh, I keep seeing these people. Mm-hmm. Like, I like these people. This is good.
How is it, are those just the ones that are well advertised? Does someone tell you to go to those? Like, how are you?
That's the culture. That is the culture of those spaces.
Sure.
Like, those ones are really well known, and anybody listening right now who's into, like, magic or plants knows exactly which ones and are like, oh yeah, that's kind of the way, or oh my, I hadn't noticed that. but that's the culture, like, from end to end in this country and pretty much, like, in any sort of Western herbal tradition or Western, you know, magic-y woo tradition. You're just gonna run into, like, very self-congratulatory racism. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of folks who are steeped in these cultures really are patting themselves on the back for being inclusive in ways that are very extractive. So, like, yes, we have an indigenous keynote speaker and we have made their life hell in every possible way and, like, painted them into a corner and asked them to, you know, wear a headdress and tell a particular kind of story and say how, you know, that kind of stuff. And calling ourselves really good at this. So that's a big part of that culture. And I just didn't know that. I hadn't been a part of that here, even though I'd been here for a long time. And so I was like, wow, this is super uncomfortable. And maybe I don't want to hang out with these people sort of on a broader scale and do this kind of stuff. So I went back home and tried to get in touch with that little kid again, the one who wanted to put the carrots and the sunflowers in the ground. And I just started sticking seeds all over my front yard because now I have the privilege of having both a front yard and a backyard. And I started growing things and it was really exciting. And, you know, I just thought, oh, well, that's nice. Like, I grew a few things. I didn't know it would become something. And this person that I had met from Sacred Lattice at the conference, Leti, invited me to come to an info session for the Pathways to Farming program for Beginning Farmers of Color by Mudbone Grown and the Oregon Food Bank. And I went to the info session and I thought, well, this program is super cool. Like, this program is helping launch like small farm businesses for folks of color who maybe have some growing experience but haven't done it as a commercial business venture. But I got a whole bunch of like imposter syndrome about it, and I didn't actually apply. I went to the info session. I thought it was great. I didn't apply. And this person, Letty, who I now farm with, was like, what are you doing? Like, the program started in January and you weren't there. And I was like, I didn't actually apply for it. They were like, that was a bummer move. What? And I just said, oh, well, you know, you had to have these 2 years of like big farm experience that I didn't have. And they were like, no, nobody had that. Like, just you should have applied. And I was like, well, it's too late now. You know, like, oh, well, I missed out. It's too late. But you know, you got a, like a solid ride or die buddy coming on when they went to the program and said, oh, do you remember Shiny? She missed the deadline, but she meant to apply and she's really interested in joining the program. And I had already said, no, thank you. Don't contact them. Yeah. And they were like, yeah, you're doing it wrong. And then sent me a text that was like, so BT Dubs, I told the program you wanted in and they asked for your phone number and they'll be calling you soon. And so I joined the Pathways to Farming program in May. So in May of 2019. So I was 5 months late to the program because it took that long to sort of get it together and figure out how I was going to do my full-time job and also have this farming incubator program. And as a part of that program, I was given access to land in Corbett. You know, if you've never been to Corbett, it's not the most comfortable place to be Black. you know, it's beautiful. It's beautiful farmland. But it is not the most comfortable place to be Black and trying to, like, launch a farm. And I am impressed by the folks who stay out there doing that all the time. But it's really hard. And so I wanted ways to connect with other folks around this new venture that I was trying to do. And I also needed a place to sell things. You know, trying to sell products, even at a farmer's market, is a huge undertaking. You know, you're talking about $1 to $2 million in liability insurance, which is a scary thing to even just to like get in business, particularly as a Black person in this country, and open your mouth and say the words $1 or $2 million self-referentially is intense feeling. And even for someone who has all of that privilege and palatability to whiteness that I had, you know, it was still really intense and overwhelming. And so I had the opportunity through the program to open a tiny farmers market at the Oregon Food Bank location. And so that's what I did, like in July of 2019, was started a very tiny little market with the intent that just the farmers in the program would sell their stuff. And the insurance was covered by Oregon Food Bank because it was on their premises. So I didn't have to think about all of this overhead. The Oregon Food Bank has a farm. And when you sell things at your farm, it's called a farm stand. And it's not regulated in the same ways as a whole bunch of other things. So it was easy. It was really easy to do. And then ironically, the farmers in the program didn't want to sell their stuff there. And so I had created this tiny little market. And now I had to go find some vendors. So I never thought I was going to be getting into the, like, vendor relations game and vendor support.
Why was that? Why did they not want to sell their stuff there?
You know, a lot of reasons, but I think primarily it's about planning, and it's stuff that I know a lot more now. But, you know, if you're going to sell things at a market in July, you needed to know that in December. And so they maybe had other outlets that they were going to sell their produce and their herbs and their flowers at, or they had gone off and started it, you know, joined a market that existed, or they were only growing it to give away to some community or to sell as a CSA or some other way that they were going to interact with the world around their stuff, or they just weren't ready and hadn't thought about it, right? Like, there's a million reasons, but fundamentally they did not have crops that they had planned to bring to a market there. So I ended up going out to get other people to come to the market. And that meant that all of a sudden I was supporting vendors, and I started to realize there's no support for this, you know, and the Pathways to Farming program graciously enrolled me in the Hacienda Empresarios program, which is like a small business startup support program and an IDA program and all of that. And we would go, several of us from the farming program, to our classes there at night and ask our little questions about taxes or, you know, insurance or whatever thing. And whatever question we had always kind of stymied them. and would just get this sort of like, well, that's farms. We don't know. You know, let's move on. You know, and I get that. Like, let's not hold up the whole session when 80% of the people in here are trying to do a thing that we do know. Well, we don't know what you're talking about. And I just kept realizing that, right, like, Portland has a ton of business support. Like, we've got a great small business development center. We are surrounded by, you know, MISO and Mercy Corps and Hacienda and all of these programs that will support up-and-coming BIPOC business owners, in fact. But if what you do is on the land, there's really nothing in terms of the business piece. Like, there are programs that are starting to emerge, like Pathways to Farming and others, to help you do the farming. But the business management piece and the getting from your farm to a marketplace somewhere doesn't exist. And so I ran that tiny little market last summer, and it was really hard.
I loved it. I went a bunch of times.
Yeah. It was really hard running the first iteration of the market at the food bank because it's not easily accessed by public transit. I really wanted communities of color to come, but it just wasn't apparent, like, how are we going to get them out there? And then there were only 10 vendors at most on a good market day. So it wasn't necessarily, you know, appealing to get there and then realize you couldn't do the same thing you could do at, say, Portland Farmers Market, where the narrative is we can replace your grocery store. And so I started to realize, like, these essential business lessons that I had actually never learned anywhere about, like, branding and demographics and, you know, competitive advantage, and realizing, like, no BIPOC farmers market really is likely to have a competitive advantage at doing standard farmers market stuff in a town like Portland that is full of farmers markets doing the standard thing. So you have to figure out how to do something different. And so I really just was accepting, you know, arts and gift vendors and all kinds of interesting people. And we had knitters and cigar box, you know, guitars.
Amazing barbecue.
Yeah, amazing barbecue. Like, all of these things. But this year, because, right, so that was a year ago. So this year in June, Jamise Coile from EcoTrust and Black Food Sovereignty Coalition sent me an email and said, "Hey, Shiny, do you still have a market brand?" And I said, "Well, I do, but it's in, you know, hibernation because we did our little test season and tried what we could. And now there's a pandemic and it's not viable to go out there. So, yeah, I do." And she said, "Well, if I had funding and support to ensure incoming BIPOC vendors and a space for you, could you launch a market?" I said, "Sure." And she said, "Great. The catch is you have to do it in June." And I said, "Jamise, it is June." It's like June 12th. And she said, "Great. So you have a couple weeks. And so how we get to the come through market that you've been to is a combination of support with EcoTrust and Black Food Sovereignty Coalition and some support from New Seasons Market really coming together. We threw together the first market in 2 weeks, launched with somewhere between 600 and 1,100 shoppers that day. Like, it was a big day. We had a line around the block the whole time. And we started out with just, you know, 5 vendors that day. It was really small. I was aiming for 10, but we only had 5 who actually showed up. By the time we ended the market season in November this year, we had done 27 vendors a market. So we averaged 24 to 27 vendors every market. But how I got there, I think, was just curiosity. Like, I just wanted to understand, you know, how do I sell my stuff? Oh, turns out that's more complicated than I thought. Okay, how does anybody sell their stuff? Oh, okay, well, that turns out to have these things attached to it. And I just sort of followed it. And then I really thought it was over for quite a while between, you know, the end of last fall of 2019 and getting that email in June of 2020. I was like, I guess my farmer's market management career was short-lived because I don't know how to do this. With all of the constraints that were going on with COVID and pandemic stuff. And so it was a little bit serendipitous and a little bit of willingness to just kind of jump. You know, I left my job at PCC in June. And Jamise didn't know that when she reached out. It was just like a fluke that she reached out within a few days of me having left being in higher ed full time to pursue farming. And I was really nervous. And I thought, I don't know how I'm going to make it go. Farming is not a super lucrative way of life. And then at just the right moment, this market manager gig popped up. And so that was really great. And what started to happen is that people kept coming to the market, white people kept coming to the market and finding me and saying, I want to support. How do I help? And that's a thing that happens a lot and often goes nowhere, right? Like everybody wants to help and then it takes work and they're busy. And I got really good at saying this incredibly audacious to me thing. And that is that people would say, how can I help? And I would say, I need $50,000 and I don't have a specific plan for it, right? Like, not like I have a program proposal for you, but I just want $50,000 for this market. And that makes you feel really foolish. Like the first couple times you just look at a person with some sort of power and say, I need $50,000. It's really intense. And so I told New Seasons Market I needed $50,000. And that's not the number we arrived at, but they did give me some fiscal support, which was really nice. And I went through about 15 people where I just kept saying, I was getting really smooth at it by the end of that. Like, hey, how's it going? Yeah, I need $50,000. Can you help me with that? And then I met a lady named Amy from the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And she said, yeah, probably. Here's my card. Email me. And so we just last week got the official word back that my $52,000 Oregon Department of Agriculture grant is in, completed, final, approved, and good to go.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So now I'm moving into the next hat I'll be wearing, which is that I'm going to run a cohort of 11 sort of growers and makers on like a field to market training program where they're going to get $1,000 stipend and a lot of support for infrastructure, startup, insurance costs, all of that kind of stuff. We'll still be running the same come through market that you and everybody else has come to know and love this summer, next season. So that's a lock. We're working through, will it be at the same location or somewhere else? But it was just this process that started with walking into a bookstore, taking a little class in a kitchen, going to a conference because someone in the bookstore kitchen mentioned it, complaining audibly to the first like brown person I saw, you know, following them when they said come along, being really foolish and getting in my own way in terms of having opportunities come up that I was not pursuing, but having like the absolute save of having a buddy who's like, yeah, we don't just let you blow off opportunities around here, so we're gonna put your name in the hat anyway.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, not only do people realize that you're good at this, and there's obviously stressful moments, but you're good at this. But I think it's really great that it seems like a bunch of your experiences and skills all to kind of weave together for this.
Yeah. You know, I think that it's like experiences and skills, and it's also, it's this other thing. So trauma makes you incredibly observant. The more trauma in your life, the more you are constantly aware of everything that's going on around you. And so it turns out that market manager and farm life is a place where all of that traumatic observationalism is really useful. And that's incredibly healing to me. So yeah, I'm busy. I'm spinning plates all the time, but like in a way that's really healing because my ability to sort of know everything happening in the market and know when a vendor has something going on and know when I need a volunteer to move to this place to do that thing. A lot of that is just shaped by having been a black kid in Oakland. Like you are constantly aware of everything going on around you because you have to be for safety. And so it turns out that that now has a productive use. And that feels so good. Right. Yeah, and so I think that's part of being good at something is you feel good at it.
Well, and that's the thing with this is you're helping other people create skills and then create futures and furtherance.
Yeah.
You know, giving them that opportunity to grow and to blossom, literally and figurative.
Yes. But,
so how, let me ask you this, how did you pick people for the market? I mean, was there an application process? Was it, you know, hey, I know I have to have these folks. I'm going to contact them and be like, hey, listen, we're doing this market. I really want you there.
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. We did have an application and a number of folks applied that way. And then I was finding out that in community, you know, every single day, so I would hear from 20 to 40 prospective vendors who were like, hey, so-and-so reached out and told me about the market, or I saw it on Instagram. I didn't know there was an application, you know? And so it was coming from all directions. People were walking into the market to find me, to ask about vending opportunities. And so it became a little bit about categories, right? So what kind of vendor are you? What is it that you sell? And in terms of gift and craft vendors, for the most part, it was just folks who applied. And really, you know, we are a BIPOC market, which for my thinking means that we first and foremost center Black and Indigenous folks in the marketplace. And so the first version of the application form just asked, like, do you identify as a person of color? And then I realized that that wasn't giving me the specificity. I didn't expect to have like 500, you know, people want to be at the market. And so having to go back and change that to ask, do you identify as a Black person or an Indigenous person or another person of color? And really choosing everywhere that we could Black and Indigenous vendors to give that opportunity to, because we were paying for their insurance. I was getting them tents donated, tables, coolers, whatever you need. Like, I'm working to get it for you. And so really wanting to keep the mission for what the market is about, you know, intact there.
So what were some of the things that you're like, you know, this person deserves a spot?
So a lot of it is about, right, like I have limited resources and I want to support people who think, they may not know yet, but they think that this is what they want to do for a living. Like, this is their passion. This is not a hobby. This is not like, I vend when my kids are, you know, off for winter break. You know, this is like, I'm out here hustling to do this thing all the time. So that was kind of one of the big ways of assessing folks, was how much are you trying to make your life about this? How central to your life would being at this market be? Because over time I started to have no-shows. So you would get, because it's free, I don't charge people to vend. Whereas other farmers markets in town charge you $60 a market. So free is great and accessible, but it also doesn't necessarily come with a hook. You know, it's easy to blow off free. Just like it's easy to say maybe to your friends, like Facebook invite, you know, like, okay. So really having to get at the heart of, you know, what is this for you? Have you done this before? Are you already doing this somewhere else? And if I'm getting folks who have a thriving business, that's awesome. And I'm really excited they're out there, but this isn't for them. Like, I wanted to give people the chance to find out if this is for you, because it's exhausting, Michael. It's exhausting to be in a white dominated marketplace as a person of color. And not everyone, no matter how much they want it to be their thing, it's not for everyone. You know, some people get through one day and they're like, no, never again. I will never again get haggled and nickeled and dimed all day long by people, because it's erosive. And so being able to offer people the opportunity to really find that out without having to have gone in debt to do it, without having to come up with $500 worth of gear and, you know, $1 million insurance policy and all of these other things, is really, really important. So what I would do differently, because it was hard to assess all of that from an application, and ultimately it became easier with the people who would walk up to me or just start talking to me because I could have a conversation. So next year it's going to be conversational, you know, like the application will be much shorter and just give me the bare demographic stuff to sort of sort through people. But then if you want to be a part of Come Through Market next year, expect to be jumping on Zoom or a phone or a socially distanced, you know, hangout so that we can talk about what it is that you're doing and your goals. And I can give somebody like a real assessment of, can I support you in that? Is this a good place for that? Because it's not the right fit for everything.
Yeah. And that's a good point that, you know, someone can look really great on paper. They can have a fancy application. You talk to them and you're just like, no, I don't think this is a good fit.
Right.
Or the other, you know, someone's extraordinary and they just didn't fill out the application as well or as, you know, it, you know, so it's kind of interesting. You know, I kind of like that component of both having the paper or the kind of application and then having some sort of conversation as well.
Yeah.
Well, you have your work cut out for you.
Yeah, that's for sure. little things.
So I have 5 questions for you. These are the 5 questions we ask at the end of the podcast.
Okay.
So the first question is, if you weren't doing this, you know, if you weren't doing Scrapberry Farms, the work you do with Hunger, Come Through Market, like what would you be doing?
I think I'd still be teaching. I mean, I'm always teaching. So where would I be teaching? I'm not 100% sure. It's possible that I would still be in higher ed. But yeah, I think in some fashion I would still be teaching people no matter what.
Okay. And besides, you know, family and friends, like what's something that consistently, well, maybe family and friends don't consistently make you happy, but what makes you consistently happy, or what can you go to bring you joy?
My dogs. I've got two dogs. I've got a little like 13-pound terrier named Mr. Dog. and I have a 60-pound like great ninny of a pit bull named Frankie. And that's, you know, those are my kids. That's where I go home every day. To those dorks, and that's absolutely like my joy.
Yeah, I hear you on that. My boyfriend and I, we have two dogs now. We adopted a second one during the pandemic.
And, yeah.
Yeah, and no matter what happens in the day or life, you come home and they just get so excited.
They give you the best jumps. That's the part I love. You walk in the door and you get the best jumps, and that's when you know, like, I really matter here.
Yeah. What do you want to do, or where do you want to go after this pandemic? Like, do you want, say I said to you, okay, you can travel somewhere. Where would you go to?
I would travel around indigenous nations here on this continent, talking to people about land stewardship practices. Like, I think there's so much to learn from people who have lived in the same place for 5,000 years. So I think that's what I would do, you know. I would start in Northern California and just work my way through a bunch of indigenous nations talking about sovereignty and plants and how to do a better job taking care of this land.
What are you either binge reading or watching these days?
I just, like a lot of people in a pandemic, binged watched the entirety of Great British Bake Off. And now I'm like obsessively consuming any form of like gentle competition reality show. So there's been like a family cook-off version. There are two different gentle flower show contests.
Oh,
like,
yeah, those are good.
Yeah.
There's a barbecue on.
Yeah, I haven't checked that one out. I don't know. Is it good?
It's pretty good.
Okay. Yeah. Like, I'm all about, like, just consuming gentle competition where people are more interested in, oh, but can we help them? We're done. You know?
Yeah, there's one Sugar Rush?
Yeah. I don't know how gentle that one is, but I'll check it out.
What about if I were to ask you, okay, you can give a TED Talk. What are you going to talk about? What would your TED Talk topic be?
Oh, man. My TED Talk is all about how access without support is not an opportunity, right? Like, so we're really into giving people access right now. So we talk a lot about how do we get land access and how do we get access to money? How do we get access to, you know, all these things? But just giving somebody land does not make them ready to have a successful farm. You know, like, we need hand-holding, we need mentorship, we need training opportunities that don't cost money. So that's my TED Talk, is people need support to really turn access into, like, a meaningful and usable opportunity that changes something in their lives.
Yeah. Well, I would be listening to that. the last part of this is shout-outs. So who do you want to give a shout out to that's doing a great job in the community? Whether it's a business, a nonprofit that you love, you see what they're doing, you're like, wonderful.
Yeah. You know, I really want to give some love to EcoTrust, and not just because they support my market, but because the way in which they have worked at supporting my market has been huge. And in particular, the EcoTrust events team. They ask me really smart, thoughtful, and hard questions. Every time pass the test on, like, hey, so how would you react if something got messed up, you know? And I think they really are doing good work at supporting sort of Black movers in food systems right now. So I would also tell everybody, keep an eye on the EcoTrust social media, because they're doing a lot of cool stuff with Black restaurateurs and chefs right now, and that's really exciting. And they're doing a lot of that in a way that isn't making them money. And I know that's got to be really hard as like an event venue in a pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. Like they need money to stay alive. But that parking lot we had the market in, I realized they were comping me $5,000 a day in venue space. Like that's huge. That's really for me, like putting things into action and not just on your strategic plan. So I think that's really huge. You know, and that's the kind of stuff we're looking for what people are doing out there is what are the verbs? What's the actions? So I'll give a little love to EcoTrust today.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate having you on the podcast and I appreciate your time. And,
for sure.
Love hearing about you, little girl in Oakland who's planting seeds.
I was trying.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It's been good.
Have a great night.
You too.
A very big thank you to Shiny for being on this episode of the podcast. To find out more about Scrapberry Farm, go to scrapberryfarm.org and be sure to follow them on social media. Again, we want to extend a sincere thank you to X-Ray FM for the 2020 X-Ray Award. Check out all the good work they're doing at 91.1 FM, 107.1 FM, and online at xray.fm. And thank you for checking out this episode of All of Your Business. You can visit us at allofyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, sponsors, and much more. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast and share with your friends. This episode was recorded at JJT Studios and edited at Track 11 Music.